How would you like to create a strategic marketing and outreach plan for your healthcare business? Gabriel Flores will tell us how to do this. And what's so special about Gabriel is he is a business leader, entrepreneur, mentor, pitch coach, committed to innovation, inclusive entrepreneurship, and community impact. And as a strategic outreach manager at Oregon Health and Science University, he forges high-impact partnerships across the Pacific Northwest. And he's the co-founder and president of Latino Founders, a nonprofit providing mentorship, funding, and resources. So, Gabriel, tell us about how a healthcare business can create a strategic marketing plan for their business.
Welcome to Awakened Titans Podcast with Lily Patrescu. Mind-blowing conversations with influential business titans sharing how you can manifest abundance, love, joy, success through quantum awakening, quantum manifestation, quantum healing, quantum miracles, exponential business growth, and innovative products and services.
Yes, this is a great question. And I think it's also important to kind of understand the paradigm that the healthcare industry is kind of going through. Let's take a step back. So again, my name is Gabriel Flores. I've actually been in the healthcare industry for about 25 years now and about 10 years in the strategic world. And historically, I think if you're in the healthcare industry, one thing you're going to notice is very a retroactive view of the market. We look at claims data, we'll look at discharge data, but all of these things have already occurred. So one of the things I think is important is specifically for an academic medical center, as you start to think about where's our assumed market opportunity? Where are these patients that need a heart transplant or cancer treatment, right? Well, in order for you to truly understand that, you have to understand your demographics. So the first thing you'll want to do is understand what is your census. So you're going to go online, you'll go to your U.S. Census and check out the Z tables and look up a specific zip code or community and really begin to start to identify what's your patient population, what's your size, what's the total market, right? And then you can start to segment that down into age groups. I like to use age bands, 18 to 24, 25 to 45, 44, and so on and so forth. And the reason these age brackets are really good is because they provide you a more of a narrow view of the market by also combining a lot of volume and thigh slices, right? Now, with that said, once you've identified your assumed market, right, the total market value, the total patients that are kind of in that region, then you can kind of start looking at prevalence rates. Now, the reason this is really important, and I think this is the reason this is a true paradigm in the healthcare market, and I really would encourage our other healthcare systems to start thinking about this as well, is one, since 2007, the national birth rate has declined over and over. And so those individuals are now 18 and over. Therefore, theoretically speaking, the United States has peaked as adults. Therefore, we're going to be getting older, we're going to be getting sicker, yet we don't have the individuals coming through the pipeline for our education to help support the needs of this growing population that's also aging. So we're going to have to be a little bit more methodical of how we provide support. And this is beginning to look at that prevalence rate. So for example, I can tell you 6.7 million or 6.7% of adults in the United States of America have heart failure. Of those individuals, 10% have advanced heart failure. And of those advanced heart failures, only a certain amount will get admitted. And of those admitted, there's only a certain amount of hearts that are transplanted annually in the United States. Therefore, you now have a prevalence rate of 0.067 chance that you're actually going to heart transplant if you have heart failure. Okay. So now that I know this information, I can then map it over map it over the entire demographics, because now I know, okay, individuals between the age of 44 or 45 and 65 are going to have this prevalence rate of heart failure, but over 65 it's this, right? And then you could also take your payer mix, okay, how much people in my market actually have Medicaid versus Medicare versus commercial. The only time you should really be focusing on your 5-year or your actual retroactive information is when you get to your finances. Let me look at my last 5 years, my net revenue, my contribution margin, operation costs, and that's going to then be able to allow you to forecast based on your prevalences. Okay, so now you've understand your market. So now I know this market over here is where my heart failure patients are going to be because I have a large volume of smokers or COPD, diabetes, obesity, whatever those comorbidities actually help increase, not necessarily help, but increase the chances of prevalence, right? And again, the disease prevalence is going to be, what's the end goal? Heart transplants, right? So whatever services that your system's providing, think of that as the end point, right? Now, what you need to understand is, how does this patient actually travel from point A to point B? So you're really starting to dig into, one, who's all in the community, what's the ages, what's the social economics, right, of determination of health, because that's also going to help you understand. One thing in particular, here in Oregon, I live in Portland, Oregon, but one thing in particular is we know our older populations tend to live further away from the hospitals. And because of that, we actually have on sicker patients that are a little bit less healthier because they live further away from these amenities, but they still need support. Even though it's just a small handful of individuals, it's still imperative that they get support. So first, we have to understand where they are. Two, we have to understand what kind of support is it that they need, right? What's the prevalence of the disease that's in that region and what's truly valuable? And then three, how do we get to them, right? This is kind of where the marketing funnel begins to come into effect, because you really have to understand what is it that they consider value, right? That they truly are like, okay, you're telling me I have some type of chance I have cancer. Cool. What's that of value to me? Right. And so then you have to start to begin to think about, okay, how do we craft this from a marketing perspective to really highlight the value of either preventative medication or screening or something that actually takes some time away from these individuals' day to do, right? That's why it has to be some type of value, because you're exchanging it for something else that they consider valuable, which is their time, which is in fact very valuable to the individuals and communities, you know, especially individuals that maybe need to continue to work to make ends meet. Maybe they don't have health insurance, right? So there's a lot of these other variables that come into effect when making these decisions for these individuals. Understanding that and understanding their community and understanding really how they like to receive their information will allow us to strategically think, okay, how do we disseminate this information, right? And once you begin to disseminate the information, again, you start at the top of the funnel, it's awareness, right? That's that dissemination, okay? Now we're being very strategic of where we're actually focusing our targeted marketing at, right? Because we look through our prevalences, we've identified this is the majority of the population are here, they're this age range, they're this sex, or whatever the case may be. Now we're starting to target that market. Okay, now what's the value of them, right? So then you have to start creating the stories, right? Really kind of pinpointing something that's relatable. One thing I really love, I use this example often, is the AT&T commercial. When you have these two people sitting in the airplane and one of them is sitting up in the front, kind of in like the coach or the, you know, economy section, and one's sitting behind. And they're like, oh, can I get a water? And they're like, yeah, it's gonna be $125 or something like that, some type of cost. And the person up in the front and the, you know, in the fancy seats is drinking their free water, you know, kind of like laughing at about it. The reason that is so unique is AT&T is a telephone company. It has nothing to do with the telephone, them sitting in an airplane and asking for a glass of water and being charged for it, whether people in front of you or not. But it's relatable. That problem, that issue, right? That those hidden fees, those are relatable. And AT&T is saying, hey, we don't do that. Even though it has absolutely nothing to do with their market, the airplane industry has nothing to do with telephone industry, it's just a relatable problem. And so really the value and the proposition you have to create is something very similar to that. How do we craft a story that is relatable to this community, that they understand, that touches them, that actually pulls at some type of emotion? Because that is marketing. You have to pull at some type of emotion. You look at any pharmaceutical commercial, and those people are going to get you excited about having upset stomach diarrhea kind of thing. Like, they make a song out of it. That's marketing, right? So they're pulling at your heartstrings. Now, of course, once you get them into your funnel, it's imperative that you have the infrastructure around you to consistently support that funnel, because the next piece is that engagement piece, right? Okay, once the patient is aware of your services and they begin to engage you with those services, how do you actually bring them down? Because essentially at the awareness, you're just disseminating information. And so the patient probably also just gather information. They may come in for a test and they may identify that they have a lineage that is a cancer genome or some other cardiovascular disease, whatever the case may be. So they may not actually need treatment. They need surveillance, right? They need to be monitored. Okay. So when that time comes, they need the treatment. Where do I go? But if we don't have that infrastructure in place, it's very, very difficult for us to sustain what we're doing. One of the things you'll see is dentists typically, they run about 2,000 patients for every one dentist, right? So that's a lot, right? So 2,000 patients for every one dentist. Historically, in the United States, we're trying to average about 40 or 50 primary care or patients per primary care doctor. So that's, still a lot of patients. Yet what we're seeing is something similar to the dentistry. We're almost 2,000 patients per primary care provider because, again, the lack of patients coming or lack of educators coming through the pipeline, older population, aging. So because of that, we're going to have to start thinking methodically about the surveillance and preventative medicines and engagement, because if you engage a patient early and you actually provide screening and prevention, we will see a healthier population. That means it brings your insurance costs down, brings your total overall health is going to be better because you're catching things sooner. Right, you're getting then that's that preventative medicine, and then it's the treatment. Right. And you get if they have to come in through adequate treatment, ensuring that you have the capacity to take on the volume. You know, one of my biggest mistakes in my career was, building up our program, one of our programs, our marquee program specifically, and bringing in an external provider and talking about all of our services and amenities and the bells and whistles of the services that this patient will be provided if they are referred to our health system. And unfortunately, the following week or day or so, they did in fact refer a patient, but we were at capacity. We couldn't take this patient in. That was detrimental to that relationship, truly. Because if you go into a community and say and promise you can do something, and I always believe in under promise, over deliver. I over promise and under delivered on that, and that will stick with a consumer, especially when you're dealing in the healthcare world, where a unique thing about customer service is, especially with patients, is that patients never necessarily go and tell everybody, like, if you did something good. And us too. Yeah, I go to a restaurant, and if I had a bad experience at a restaurant, I'm going to go on to Yelp and tell them about that bad experience almost 9 times out of 10. But if I have a good experience, which is a majority of the time, I rarely go on there and leave a review, because it's those lasting impacted moments, those really negative. And again, they're not just telling Yelp, they're telling everybody on Yelp. They're going to go on social media, they're going to share that review. And so having that one bad experience with a family member could absolutely be detrimental as well, because they may want to leave the provider that referred that patient to that service, may no longer want to refer any family members to you. And so it becomes a cascade of fall of really financial hardships, right? I think historically, and this is kind of the last piece, the loyalty, right? When you get down to that last piece of the funnel, historically, in the healthcare world, you've seen a strong need for competition. It's volume, 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 volume. Let's get the best volume. Who cares what the volume is? But what we're going to have to, what we're going to see again in this paradigm shift is individual, like hospitals and systems that will survive, are going to kind of rest on their loins a little bit, really focus on what is their zone of genius versus their core competency. Because at the end of the day, we can't do it all. You can't be population health and complex surgery and, behavioral health, and you can't do it everything, right? So partnerships and collaborations are going to need to be established. That does not mean mergers and acquisitions. That means partnerships and collaborations. I think it's also imperative that these independent individual hospitals and community clinics retain their brand and their brand recognition and their ownership of their, because they, at the end of the day, they know the community better than an academic medical center does. That's where I work, right? An academic medical center. So we help train the future doctors that hopefully will work and reside in some of these rural areas as well. But having this pipeline that is strategic, it starts with prevalence, right? It's really truly identifying who needs the service and why, right? Is it lung cancer? Is it cardiovascular disease? What is it? Right. You could also, and this information is all public information. You can go on the NCI, you can go on the cancer registries, and all this information is available. Right. And so you can then just analyze it and say, okay, well, I now see, based off of the national rate of 78% mammograms, right? The goal is to get to 78% of individuals over the female population. And if we're only at 50, okay, well, now you have an outreach plan, right? Let's go focus on getting some breast surgeries or screenings done, or colorectal screenings. The same data applies, right? And again, all of this is going to do is going to help you financially about lower costs. It's going to lower your admission, readmission rates, and all of these things we caught earlier. It'll allow you to support the services that are of need in the community without also plugging up the system. Because unfortunately, like I've said before, we're not going to be able to do it all. So I think that last iteration is going to be having to identify, you know, collaborators and supporters and partners that have a focus on a zone of genius that your either academic medical center or community hospital or clinic does not focus on, and really create pathways, referral pathways to that specific service. Because at the end of the day, if a community provider is working with an APP or a FNP or a nurse practitioner or whoever, and they're working these patients all the way up through the pipeline, and they have direct access to a provider in a complex specialty area, it's going to be much easier for them to be able to have a communication pathway back and forth versus having to send in a referral and wait months at a time for these things to occur. And then now it's, you know, the patient is actually further down and there in their diagnosis, making it a difficult, the outcomes a little bit harder to predict. But nonetheless, I think that's kind of the funnel in a quick, you know, 10-minute synopsis. So if you have any questions, Lily, I'd be very happy to answer them.
Thank you. Tell us about how can you support clinics to create a strategic marketing outreach plan for their business?
Yes. Yeah, so I'm always happy. I'm working, you know, as a consultant. I certainly help provide those services where I will actually look at your patient service areas. Give me your zip codes. We'll look at your zip codes. We'll begin to identify what's your total population. Then we'll start to apply the prevalence rates, right? Total number of COPDs, adult smokers, AFib, obesity, you know, all of these informations. And then also look at the cancer registry to begin to determine, well, what's your screening rates and where are those individuals need support. From there, we can kind of break it down a little bit further and get a little bit more granular and start to, and I like to put these in an actual visual presentation. So it's not just an executive write-up summary. You get the raw data and you'll actually get an executive presentation as well as a document outlining that information. But what really this provides you is true KPIs and tactics to say, okay, you know, for example, I just did one recently where about if we just did 5% of the screenings for colorectal, 5% was 15,000 additional screens. So that's a huge lift, right, for this community hospital. So it's one, understanding what the lift is as well, and operationally, is that something that we could truly do now, or is it something we should be striving towards? Because at the end of the day, there's things you know, there's things you know you don't know, but there's a lot of things we don't know. And looking at prevalence rates and looking at data and really understanding where does this patient volume come from and how does this patient eventually wind up to that surgical treatment or transplant or, right, the need for healthcare intervention, how does that typically run down this pipeline? And then what are the processes in between each one before they get to either the clinic or to the surgery, right, or to the ED? Because that's the goal, is to essentially prevent the ED visits, right, to lessen those readmission rates as well. But again, having a clear five-year plan that is also embedded with quarterly plans that saying, like, you know, this is our market, this is our end goals in 5 years, certainly. Okay, where are we at now on this scale from 1 to 4 in our relationship? Are we at the awareness stage, the evaluation, right, the conversion, or the loyal? Where are we at? And then what tactics in each one of those stages do we actually do to move them to the next stage? And are we ready for that process? Because again, you may not be operationally ready to move into every single market. So really identifying which market are we currently doing, where are we at, how do we grow into it, and where do we end up eventually want to be? At the end of the day, we want relationships with everybody, certainly. I want volume from everyone. But tactfully and operationally, we actually can't take it all, right? We just cannot. So where should we be focusing our energy the most? Where are the community partners that would allow us to kind of alleviate some of the restraint we may have on our own capacity, and maybe even support them in their capacity by taking on some of the care that they're unable to support? And then how do we bridge all of it, right? Because again, we can't do it all. One of the biggest things that here in Oregon is the lack of proctors to help support our educators and bring up the next line of defense, right? The next medical students. And so it's really having to start at a grassroots effort. So I'm glad you actually said clinics, because I believe clinics are truly, they're the front door, right? You're going to see your family medicine, internal medicine, you know, FNP before you'll see a complex surgical transplant, surgery, whatever, right? And so starting at that grassroots level is extremely important. But that's how I'd be able to support the clinics is really getting granular on the data, identifying your assumed market, right, based on prevalence rates, and then actually build out an outreach strategy plan to say, hey, this is how we can actually target that market and try to actually decrease the incident rates or mortality rates or what we're seeing in prevalence rates of diseases within the community.
Thank you. What are the biggest mistakes that you've noticed the most unsuccessful healthcare businesses tend to...
Trying to be the jack of all trades, master of none. I mean, I've also fallen into this as well. You kind of think about it as a quadrant, right? You got four boxes. Think of four boxes, right? One box is going to be price, right? One box is going to be complex care. One box is going to be technology. And one box is going to be like, you know, customer service or outcomes. The last one will be outcomes. So price. Well, if you're going to be the lowest price, you're probably not going to be, you can't be the most complex. Because at the end of the day, you're going to have to invest in funding and new technology, new imaging, new support systems, so you can in fact be the most complex. So you have to make that determination. Do you want to be the most complex or do you want to cost the least? Okay. Same thing. Do you want to be the most innovative, right? Or do you want to have the most outcome, the best outcomes? Because if you're trying to be the best innovative hospital in the world, you're possibly wrongly not going to have the best outcomes because you're going to be doing cutting edge healthcare, right? You're really looking at clinical trials, research trials. You're looking at things that are outside the box in that regard. But if you're wanting the best outcomes, then you're probably going to play it a little safe, right? What you have tend to see, if you're trying to be the best in all four of those, you're going to fail. Because again, you can't be the cheapest with being the most complex, and you can't have the best outcomes. You're trying to be the most innovative. Those are two pendulums that they sway the opposite way, right? It's kind of like the whole evolution of the power, right? The bigger the engine, the bigger the power, right? But now they're trying to invert it. So the smaller engines, more power, but it's difficult to do. And I think that's the same kind of concept. You can't try to create extremely big engines. All you're trying to build a car in the middle of a race if you're doing that. And so really being methodical, looking at a quadrant and saying, again, complexity of services, the cost of services, the outcome of their services, and the innovation of this. Which two of those boxes am I going to be the best at? Because I could be the best and I can innovator and I can provide the best complex care. Or I can be the most cost efficient and also provide the best outcomes, but those two will not be able to match. So again, thinking of the quadrant and being thoughtful of where you lie and being honest, because again, that you can't do it all. And that's historically where I've seen, organizations and community hospitals and clinics kind of tend to fail.
Thank you. Tell us some of your most successful case studies of companies, healthcare businesses that you've collaborated with, where you've helped them to create a strategic marketing plan or outreach plan where they have increased their revenue or they have had some sort of success.
Yeah, that's a great question. One area I love going is the Southern Oregon region. And really, I don't consider it my success. It's certainly their success and the community success. So I really don't take any ownership, but building that relationship and again, thinking about the relationship funnel and referring provider funnel. When I first started, connecting with this region back in 2005, I believe it was 2006, or sorry, 2015, 2016, I didn't really have a good rapport, right? So it was didn't know I'm cold calling folks, and so I began to start with education. Again, the value. What's the value? Right, the value is education. I'm coming from an academic medical center. I'm able to provide continuing medical education credits. So these individuals are now getting a free education and an academic credit that actually goes to their licensing, right, at the end of the year. So that was the value proposition I came with. I have this free CME. I'll even bring some lunch, right? So once we started building that rapport, I'm going to do this for a couple of years, and then the pandemic, right before the pandemic hit, I started to actually build a lot of strong relationships with the team down there, the cardiologists in particular. And once we started to build that relationship there in the pandemic hit, the conversation began, how do we actually, really solidify this relationship? And so again, the way my mind works, the CMEs are the awareness stage, right? The evaluation stage is now me having conversations with these cardiologists in the region, right? These community providers and building that rapport. Now it's the conversion stage. So going down there with our providers, our advanced heart failure providers, and actually building and supporting a shared patient model with that region. And so once we've established the shared patient model between our heart failure patients and their community providers, we now have an instant line of communication, really easy pathway of referral. Now, 50% of our heart transplants come from that region. It's a large volume of transplants that come from that region. One, two, that hospital in that region nationally has the second lowest heart failure readmission rates in the country. That's nothing. I'm not taking any responsibility. That's because of the dedication of their local cardiologist and the relationship that they have with our academic medical center to quickly get these patients the support and care they need, where now the patient that has heart failure, they no longer, they get readmitted. And their readmission rate is really very low. And you can go look, if you don't believe me, go look, you can Google it. The second lowest heart failure readmission rate in the country. And this is a small community in Southern Oregon, not a small community, a community hospital in Southern Oregon. And so that's one where I think that was really, really unique, that has now, blossom into other relationships outside of the cardiovascular area. And so, again, being methodical and identifying the value of providing the support and making sure you have the operational put through to support it is very imperative. But then also continuing, right? That loyalty aspect is going back over and over, and I'm actually going to go back down there in April, and I try to get down there almost once a quarter, not necessarily to do much other than enjoy some coffee and then go get the restaurant and really just reestablish those relationships that, well, I've now spent a decade building. But that I would say is one of my funnest, coolest little success stories, I should say.
Thank you. Tell us about what needs to happen in the branding or marketing message so that when patients come and experience the clinic or the healthcare business, they actually want to be kind of to continue to be patients of that particular healthcare business.
Yes, great question. And it's kind of a two-pronged answer because you really have two different target audience. One, you're going to have their patients, right? And the other one, you're going to have the referring provider. So like myself, since that provider is going to refer their services to me. So first, we'll start with the patients. The patients, it's really going to be boots on the ground. And unfortunately, it's still going to be the patient stories of success, but also make them relatable, like I was mentioning. I think if you see yourself, for example, creating community events where you're having screenings done for patients for free, you can get hundreds of patients in at one time. We've done this successfully in the coastal regions where we'll take a 8-hour day and we'll have a provider as one patient's being room, the provider's seen another patient room, and just keep going all day. We were able to see about 100 or so plus patients right then and there. Some of them got biopsied and scheduled for those. And so the benefit impact with that was immediate, right? For the community, they saw the impact. They saw the actual, us in the community, our brand in the community, right? The leave the shirts behind and so on and so forth. So that's the patient one, right? That's the community impact. You have to be boots on the ground and you have to be invested in the community, because out of sight, out of mind. If I don't see you across the table, then you're not truly a part of this community. So being there is extremely important from the patient's perspective. From the provider perspective, it's a little different, right? It is really about, one, like, what is the value, right, of supporting anything? And then what is the service? So to make it relatable from a marketing perspective, and I go back to the continuing medical education piece I was talking about. One thing I'm always encouraging our providers to do when they go out and do a CME lecture in any community is make it like, you have to be able to present the data, but then make it practical. And the best way to do that is do a case study, right? You have blind information, you don't put patient name or anything like that, but you'll talk about a patient XYZ showed up with this symptoms, age 45, da da da, and kind of go down the general patient problem list, and then begin to ask, okay, what would you guys do during this situation, A, B, or C, right? Kind of engage the audience, right? Because one, they're now also talking to you, engaging with you, now building a rapport as a presenter. Two, you're also presenting a case study that just makes that data that you just presented practical sense to them now. I get it, because you're putting in practice. But lastly, if you can, try to have that case study one of their community patients. Because again, if you're like myself, an academic medical center, the likelihood you have seen a patient from that community is going to be pretty high. So, and especially one that's probably has been seen recently, because that tends to be the reason they're interested in that subject, right? Maybe they just had a patient with, some peripheral cardio disease, and they're interested in this very sub service, right? And so trying to use the case study as a patient that, again, it's going to be blind, but they might be familiar with the patient and understand, like, oh, yes, or familiar with a similar patient. And it's like, oh, yeah, I remember having a similar patient to that. That is also going to be very huge. But outside of the marketing piece, all of that will fall apart, all of it, without communication. Communication back to the patient, communication back to the provider of what is happening. Because if it's always kind of put on the earnest of the patient to do everything, to follow up, to make an appointment, to call this, to do that, those patients are going to fall through the crack. Because eventually, my time is valuable. Their time is extremely valuable. So if there are ways to simplify these processes, that in itself is the biggest branding tool you'll have. And I think, again, the paradigm shift with the cost of insurance possibly continuing to rise and things of that nature, you can kind of expect that you may see more cash patients, individuals that actually do not have insurance that wish to pay, call it the concierge service, right? Where they want cash services. So that's another kind of marketing play too. If you're starting to go down that marketing vertical where you're seeing, cash patients focused on concierge services, then you really want to be a concierge. They want the white glove treatment, like valet parking. I want nice coffee in the waiting room, or like sodas and waters. I don't care if it's not healthy or not. I want to feel comfortable, right? And so thinking about, again, what all that is. And at the end of the day, the unique thing about healthcare is it's very much on surveys. So you have press gaining, you have your patient satisfaction scores, and those are all tied to financial performances, right? And so the unique thing about those two is if you're working in the patient experience or one of those departments, I have formerly worked in that for a decade as well. One of those things is look at your correlation coefficient. Okay, just look at one problem. Just look at one problem. And if I can move that from a 3 to a 4, that might be a 10% or, you know, larger impact, just that one question than any other question, right? Some of it might be the noise complaints or the smell. One of the things we implemented at our hospital was, because of the noise complaints, we always had, you know, the handicap doors with the metal frames, you kind of hit them to open. Well, patients were sleeping in the patient's room and, you know, walk through the units and slam the, you know, the handicap door to open it. Well, eventually they're like, this is loud. You're slamming the wall. So eventually they got the ones that were censored. So we just walk by and you wave your hand, the door's open, improved our scores dramatically from a sound perspective, right? The inpatients were no longer complaining about us banging the wall. Another thing is I did an analysis on dual occupancy rooms. Patients that were in dual occupancy rooms had a length of stay of like almost one day longer than patients in a single occupancy rooms, and their patient scores were horrible. So also, you know, it's not only marketing that's like externally, but it's also the internal marketing as well, right? If a patient does come into your healthcare system, does get admitted, okay, what does that marketing look like as well, right? It's the ambiance and the decor. So it's kind of all of it.
Thank you. What can healthcare businesses do to maintain a long-term relationship with the suppliers, with the hospitals that are continuously referring them patients?
That's a great question. And I really love this question because I think it goes back to the need for this partnerships, collaborations. One, again, we can't do it all ourselves. Identify a partner, collaborator, and see if we can jointly recruit a member of service so they can actually support your community, right? Maybe it's a general cardiologist or a urologist or whatever the case may be. But you don't necessarily have to do it yourselves, because if you do a co-recruitment, right, you might be able to obtain, if you especially go with an academic medical center, might be able to get a provider easily or a little bit, have a larger net to pull from, I would say. Now, that's one. Two, identify those needs. Like, again, going back to the prevalence rates, determining what is it that your community truly needs. And maybe there's a subspecialty services that's already in that community that would be able to willing to come to your hospital or your clinic and do a day clinic there or 2 day clinic there, right? They don't necessarily have to be there full time. And you don't necessarily need to have them coming through be under your brand. Because again, it might also alleviate some of the operational expenses having them come and using your facility where you actually have 2 operation or 2 exam rooms currently idle. They have a large patient panel. Why not utilize that space and leverage it out, right? Because that's also a new revenue stream for you. It's taking away some of the operational costs for having those empty exam rooms, but you're also actually improving the patient outcomes, because now you're actually getting preventative and screening care much, much sooner. But lastly, I think this is the biggest piece is leveraging the buying power. You mentioned it, the suppliers. Obviously, the costs of goods and supplies has gone dramatically. The cost of employment consistently is the highest cost of healthcare. But when it comes to supplies, you know, leveraging the economies of scale is important. And this is something I preach in our entrepreneurs at Latino Founders as well. How do you group together a group of people and make a larger purchase? So for example, one of the things we do here in Portland, Oregon, pretty well is our co-packing facilities. You'll have a non-alcoholic beverage next to a coffee maker, next to a candy maker, because they all use these raw goods, right? They all need a sugar. Well, it's cheaper to buy like a sugar as a ton at a time, truly like 1 ton of sugar. It's by cost of scale, right? It's actually cheaper to do that than it is to buy sugar a pound at a time. Just like you see like with cereal or milk, right? The more you bet, like you go to Costco, right? The more things you get, the cheaper it becomes, right? Well, if you group yourself together and you create a buying power kind of a community, right? We all need gloves. We all need masks. We all need these things. So if we create these relationships and really start to leverage our economics of scale to our buying power advantage, that is really going to also help create, at least eliminate some of the headwinds that I think the healthcare industry is facing financially. I also believe that is true with the payer industry. I think that state and community hospitals, academic medical centers, and communities need to kind of band together when it comes to the table for larger insurance companies and say, hey, no, we here in Oregon, we are actually 96,000 square miles, and we're going to support the entire state, and we're doing it all together. So we have all of these, yeah, they're communities and different clinics, but at the end of the day, we all see the same Oregonian, right? And so with that kind of preface, going back to the tables and saying, hey, we're coming this collectively. If you want to support the 96,000 square miles, not just the 100,000 lives here or 1,100 whatever lives, no, the entire 96,000 square miles. If you want to support all Oregonians, this is what we're wanting. This is how we need to work together, because no hospital, no academic medical center, no community is going to succeed if we're seeing community hospital or clinic or support constantly being closed down because of financial hardship or because of the cost of goods are too high, right? And so the healthcare is it's an economy driver. It truly is. Because at the end of the day, if you have a healthier population, you want more people will go there. Sometimes you're not just recruiting the provider, you're recruiting their significant other. So what amenities does that community have for the significant other? They need to have good schools, good restaurants, right? And once you start building those things up, it's all around the healthcare center. You'll start to see a flourishment of the local economy. But again, it's very difficult to scale anything if the cost of goods continues to rise, as well as the cost of service, which is our paid service and employee, which again, I'm not making any argument and saying that they get paid too much. Absolutely not. What I am saying, though, is those costs continue to rise while our revenues continue to dwindle.
Thank you. Tell us where healthcare businesses can connect with you.
Yes. Yeah. So best way to connect with me is feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn, Mr. Gabriel Flores. That's a very good way for me to connect with you. And you can actually see my work as well. I'm certainly available as well at, you can email me at g.flores, F-L-O-R-E-S at latinofounder.com. It's latinofounder.com. Again, that's a nonprofit. I'm also happy to, if you have coaching or if you need some support from an entrepreneur, if you're looking for a business accelerator, we run Pitch Latino. We recently got that trademark. And just last year, the nonprofit raised over $1.2 million, where I'm the co-founder and the president. And we gave out roughly, I think it was $60,000 of unrestricted grant funding to entrepreneurs. Our goal is very simple. Our goal is to help scale 100 businesses to $1 million of annual recurring revenue. So it's very, very much in line with the healthcare role I'm currently doing, of focusing on scaling, services as cancer and cardiovascular and those services, while over here focusing on just all types of verticals, right? Consumer packaged goods, outdoor healthcare. So it's very, very unique, because it also provides a little more of an education and a challenge for myself as well, right? Constantly looking at new problems and new ways to find solutions. But again, LinkedIn, Mr. Gabriel Flores is a great way, or g.flores at latinofounder.com are two great ways.
Follow us for more interviews with world's most influential business titans, providing you with the insights to awaken to your full potential so you can get paid to be yourself, find true happiness, and manifest anything you desire.